In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Russia, about what's been happening recently in Russia, and about the relationship between Russia and the United States. And as our guest this morning, we have Marshall Goldman. He's Associate Director of the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard University and has been following Russia and the Soviet Union for a long time. He's the author of a number of books on the subject, just to mention a couple of them. What Went Wrong with Perestroika, that book was published in 1992, then one in 1994 titled Lost Opportunity, Why Economic Reforms in Russia Have Not Worked. He's written a number of others, basically having to do with the same sort of subject about Russian politics, about the changes that have occurred there as we moved from the age of the Soviet Union to Russia. He's also interested in and has written about environmental issues in Russia and the former Soviet Union. And he's also, from time to time, been good enough to talk with us about some of these same subjects. And we're pleased to have the opportunity to talk with him once again. As we talk, of course, your questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. Otherwise, if you're here locally, use the other. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. And at any point here, if you'd like to call us, you're certainly welcome to do that. Professor Goldman, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us again.
It's good to talk to you again.
The Bush administration, as people know, and we've certainly talked about it here in this program, has declared its intention to build a defensive system to protect the country against a small number of incoming ballistic missiles, which, among other things, would involve abrogating the ABM Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty that we signed on to way back in 1972. Some of our allies are not terribly happy about this, and also China and Russia are not terribly happy about it. Recently, when Mr. Bush met with Mr. Putin, we got two sort of versions of what their conversation about this was. From the Bush administration, the impression that this was something that the Russians essentially were willing to deal with and we could make this part of a larger discussion about arms control between the two countries. Shortly after that, the comments coming out of Russia were, well, that's not quite right. We're still not comfortable with this. We don't like it. And that the Bush administration's sort of spin on this, it's something that we could make okay, was not quite the way it was on the Russian side. What can we say now about the Russians, what they think about this whole missile plan, what they think about the U.S. walking away from the ABM treaty, and the likelihood that we'll find some way to work this out that both sides will be happy about?
I've just come back from Russia and had some talks with some people there about it. They are basically opposed to the whole notion of doing away with the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty, partly because they've been comfortable the way things have gone, although they've not gone so well for Russia as a country in the recent times. I mean, the economic problems, the political problems, but in terms of tensions between the East and the West, we haven't gone to war, and that's quite an accomplishment. But they also say that this ABM treaty from 1972 has to be taken in the context of that there are 30 other treaties that stem from that, which would also be thrown into jeopardy. And they say, we don't know where that will lead because everything is up for grabs. And by the way, you keep telling us that our business practices are terrible, which is true, and that we have no corporate governance procedures that are honored by the courts or that are enforced by the courts. And you keep accusing us of breaking our contracts. But the treaty that you signed with us was a contract, and now you're breaking that contract. And how do you feel about that? You don't see it that way in the United States, but you signed an arms control treaty, and now you're unilaterally saying we're going to abolish it. So you've got to really look this. I think we have to appreciate their point of view. That's what I guess the point I'm trying to make.
Mm-hmm. I know that last year you were among a group of individuals you're talking about here, about academic people, former diplomats, people in the foreign policy community, who all publicly said, and this was during the time that the President Clinton was still in office, publicly said that you did not think that this, the plan for building this national missile defense, was a good idea, and urged the administration to not to do this. And I'm assuming that you have not changed your mind about this.
No, I haven't. What I was reporting you, the Russians were saying, is indeed their view, but it's also my view. It's kind of bewildering to see how both administrations seem to be pursuing this. Now, the whole notion, of course, is there are rogue nations out there, and that's true. I mean, I give both President Bush and President Clinton credit for seeing that the Cold War confrontation has changed. That's not to say that things should be frozen forever, because indeed it does suggest that the things have changed. We should really be looking for it. But we don't want to, I don't think we want to undo something that's been working. What we want to do is add something to it, perhaps, that may anticipate things in the future, but not at the cost of destroying what has worked well. Part of the problem I think that we have is that President Bush goes over there, President Putin seems to say, well, okay, we get along. I've been invited to the ranch. I've been invited the President Bush to come visit me in Moscow or St. Petersburg, my old hometown. And he doesn't get all upset and start banging his shoe on the table as we became accustomed in the Khrushchev era. So we say, well, okay, the Russians don't seem to be all that upset. But then they go home the next day and they say, we didn't make any far-reaching agreement. Don't get carried away with this whole idea. And so, you know, we don't really appreciate how deeply disturbed they are by the whole concept of the national missile defense thing and the expansion of NATO. And they also go on to say, well, maybe we can work with these rogue nations, North Korea, Iran, Iraq, or at least from we Russians can do that and try to bring them into the world order. Or in any case, if granted they are rogue nations, and granted that they may want to destroy the United States, they're not going to do it with a missile. They're going to send over a truck or some kind of ship and let it anchor offshore. Because if they send off a missile, we'll know immediately from whom it came, and they'll be destroyed in the process. Mm. So they just think it's kind of, they see this all as an excuse for destroying the ABM treaty, which will then allow us to build up this thing ultimately to be directed against them, despite what we say.
It certainly seems that the Bush administration, the signals that they're giving are confusing. That on the one hand, Mr. Bush talks about wanting to have a positive relationship with Russia and stressing in a way that perhaps previous presidents have not, that Russia is not our enemy anymore and we should stop thinking that way. So saying things like that on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, as far as the ABM treaty and the plan to build this missile system goes, saying that we're going to do this no matter what anybody says, and if the Russians don't like it, that's tough, which makes it a little difficult to try to understand exactly, as far as Russia is concerned, what the attitude of the Bush administration is.
Well, I think you're right again, and you know, on the one hand, just you know, to kind of extend your thought, President Bush, when he begins his administration, said we're not going to do anything special for Russia, and he has a point, and his Secretary of the Treasury O'Neill and the Secretary of Commerce make statements to the effect that the Russians don't follow international business practices. They've got their economy in the state that it's in. We're not going to do anything to help their economy. And then President Bush goes and meets the Russian President Putin in Slovenia and says, hey, I looked into this man's eyes and I can read his soul, and I see this is a man I can trust who can work with us, and I'm going to invite him to the ranch. Now, it's the Russians, you know, I say it's terrific because the Russians are very fond of Putin, but not for the same reasons we are. I mean, they like him because he's come from the KGB, and he's tough, and he's cracking down on a lot of things that he saw. But for President Bush to say he can trust him, it's not a man I would trust, I'll tell you that. And so on the one hand, President Bush is, as you say, opening up and saying, we want to be friends. On the other hand, there are all kinds of signs that he had earlier that we're just going to stand off from dealing with Russia. So that you keep getting these flip-flops, and it is confusing. And it's confusing not only for the Russians, I got to say. It certainly is also confusing for people who are conservative in this country who wonder what did President Bush have that day, or are President Putin's eyes so piercing they hypnotize you?
Is there any way at this point to think about how it is this might play out if both sides continue to take the position that they have?
Well, it is conceivable there are some solid problems here that both sides, common interests that both sides have. The Russians want very much to reduce their nuclear stockpiles. That's not because they don't like nuclear weapons. It's because they can't afford to sustain. They've got something about 6,500 now. They want to reduce them to 1,500. And we want to reduce ours, too. And President Bush said we were going to do that unilaterally, although I don't think he initially thought he would get down to 1,500. So the Russians would say, okay, let's agree we want to reduce our nuclear stockpile. And the Americans are saying, well, you know, we're not the only ones who could be affected by some bandit country out there, some rogue nation out there who might have a missile. So you may want to protect it. So maybe we could do something, and it's possible we could work out some kind of joint arrangement, not so much against North Korea, but, say, against Afghanistan, because the Russians are paralyzed by Afghanistan. It frightens them. So, you know, they accept the notion there are rogue nations. What they want to guard against is that this is not some devious device to build up a system whereby we can launch a first strike and not have to worry about retaliation from the Russians. That's what they fear.
In this hour of Focus 580, we're speaking with Marshall Goldman. He's Associate Director of the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard University, has been watching the Soviet Union and Russia for a long time, has written a number of books on it, and occasionally has talked with us here on this program about these very topics. And questions certainly are welcome if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. A few weeks ago, in the middle July, the president of China, Jiang Zemin, was in Moscow to meet with Russian President Putin, and they signed the first treaty involving the two countries, as to my understanding, in more than 50 years. Let's just first of all talk about just what this treaty was all about, this friendship, quote-unquote friendship pact between China and Russia.
Well, what it really was about was the Russians playing the China card against the United States and the Chinese playing the Russian card against the United States. There were some concrete things that were signed there, and I can talk about those in a second. But basically, they're saying, look, these Americans are crazy out there, and let's try to see what we can do to cooperate and add our voices to concerns about the national missile defense and other things. I think that's really the main motivation. Also associated with that is both of them want to increase their standing in the world arena. And so this is where President Putin has been, in fact, going around the periphery, dealing with countries that are hostile to the United States, but also those countries that have been traditionally our allies in Western Europe, and trying to work out new arrangements with them, establish friendship treaties of different sorts. He's been particularly active in Great Britain and with the Germans. So this, in some sense, was just this, if the Americans are going to go around breaking treaties, we're going to try to show that we're part of the world community. And that's part of it. But then in addition, the Chinese have become Russia's major customer for military equipment. And the Russians are selling them some very sophisticated things. Right after this friendship agreement was signed, there was an announcement that the Chinese had bought some of Russia's most advanced aircraft, which causes some concern not just outside in Taiwan and in the United States, but even in Russia, because they're never quite sure how enduring this friendship treaty or will be, given the fact that Russia and China actually were shooting each other in 1960. So there's partly that. Also, they've had a contentious border, and this certified that parts of that border that had been contentious before have they've worked out arrangements of where the line between the two countries is, and although there are still some portions of it that have not been agreed to, but on the whole, it was that talking about trade. We've got to increase our trade, although there's nowhere near amount of the trade between Russia and China that there is between Russia, China and the United States. In our case, it's we're buying close to $100 billion worth of stuff a year from China. It's hard to go into any department store or discount store and find something not made in China, whereas in the case of the Russians, the Chinese buy or sell just $5 billion. But it was trade, it was arms, it was politics, and I don't know if it went beyond that, but that's certainly enough.
Certainly, during the Cold War, there was friction between the Soviet Union and the Chinese at times. There were other times when I guess one might have said that the relationship was civil, maybe not cordial. But it seemed that there was enough friction and there was enough dividing them so that the United States perhaps didn't really have to worry about very much about the possibility that they would come into serious conflict with both of those nations, that is, allied with one another. Now, is this the increasing ties between Russia and China, is that really something for the United States to be worried about?
Well, let me add, in the 1950s, they were very close, and they were talking about monolithic communism. That was, you know, in the early part of the 50s, Stalin and Mao, and then later on it got a little tense with Khrushchev. But for a while, I mean, I hate to show that I was a graduate student, but I remember being a graduate student listening to this business about monolithic communism, and it was whether it was true or not, it turned out it was only temporarily true. It was pretty scary. Certainly in terms of the number of, you know, in terms of the population of the world who were devoted to this thing. But then, as you say, it became lukewarm, and then in 1960, the armies were fighting each other across the, they've got a common border, and it's not like the Canadian border. It is armed, and there have been frictions. I don't think that we have to worry about them. They've got enough issues that difference, that divide them. I don't think you have to worry them about joining up to, you know, militarily or anything. Politically, they could. For many months, Russia, after the collapse of communism, was quite supportive of what we want our foreign policy in the UN and elsewhere. The case of the Chinese, we have more of a problem there because Russia is just recovering after having lost, maybe almost half of its GNP, and it's gone through some terrible times. It's not a superpower anymore, is kind of the shorthand way of putting it. China is just beginning to manifest its destiny. It's beginning to flex its muscles, and to the extent that they do that economically and militarily, they are going to bump into us, and we're going to bump into them. And so there's more to worry about there. Russia was always strong militarily, but its economy didn't give them the wherewithal, or certainly doesn't do it now, to make it a contentious power. And so now it's kind of retrenching, as it were. So I think the Russians are, and Putin in particular, are acute enough to see this and candid enough to see this. But the Chinese, this is going to be more of an issue. And if I were the people in the Bush administration, as the same thing in the Clinton administration, that's something that's going to take a lot of diplomacy and a lot of clever thinking of how to allow for this growth. You can't say you can't grow. Allow for this growth and also, you know, kind of sublimate their energy and ambitions.
As I was reading about this, it came across an article about another dimension of this, which seems not to have gotten a lot of attention or as much attention. And that happened, about a month before this agreement between Mr. Jiang and Mr. Putin. And that was when China, Russia, four former Soviet Central Asian republics all joined together in something called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which Mr. Zhang apparently called the Shanghai Pact, maybe intending to evoke, at least in the words of one writer, the former Warsaw Pact. And there also, I guess, is the possibility that some other countries would like to join this, including Iran, Mongolia, Turkmenistan. And this begins to sound rather ominous. I don't know. Is that being alarmist to look at this in this way?
I think in that sense, yeah. What the real reason for the Shanghai Agreement or Pact or whatever you want to call it has almost nothing to do with us, or at least on the surface it doesn't. It's mainly directed against Islamic fundamentalism. Every one of those countries is having a terrible trouble with Islamic fundamentalists coming from Afghanistan and even Iran. We think of Iran as being a terrorist nation, harboring terrorists and doing the right things. But they're worried on their flank by, again, Afghanistan and the Mujahideen and, the Taliban. All these countries are really worried about that, in particular the Central Asians. They're fighting. There's a war going on in Tajikistan. There are incursions that come over from Afghanistan. Same thing happens in Kyrgyzstan or Kyrgyz. And recently there's similar problems in both Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. So that's the main focus. And the Chinese, of course, have their problems with the Uyghurs, who are not so much fundamentalists, but just simply a minority, an Islamic Muslim a minority. And they're, because the Chinese clamped down, the fundamentalists gain a foothold there as well. So that's the main issue. And from the Russian side, I just add it would also be what's going on in Chechnya, where the Russians rationalize what they're doing by serving as a bulwark against the incursion of Islamic fundamentalism into Europe.
Right. I certainly want to go on and talk a bit about that, but we have a caller here. We'll bring them into the conversation, and I'll introduce again our guest here. We're at our midpoint. We're speaking with Marshall Goldman. He is Associate Director of the Davis Center on Russian Studies at Harvard, and we're talking about Russia, what's been going on there recently, about the relationship between Russia and the United States. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Caller here to talk with is in Peoria, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, after the communism was broken up in Russia, all the land at one time belonged to the government. Caterpillar is building a small tractor at St. Petersburg, Russia, because the farmers got small tracts of land and they don't need big tractors.
Well, it sounds like you're coming from Caterpillar in Peoria, but you're right. That's exactly the problem. The Russians built these factories to mass produce tractors and mass produce massive tractors, which would take advantage of economies of scale. And to the extent they're setting up new farms, and they haven't been very successful in doing that, by the way, but to the extent they do, the farmers need smaller equipment, and not these massive tractors, and they didn't produce them. So this was an opportunity for a while for American manufacturers, European manufacturers, to sell them smaller tractors. The trouble is that the system didn't generate enough profits to pay for it, and when they did, usually that wasn't forthcoming either. So there's a market there, a potential market, but right now the Russians haven't made the shift to doing this kind of thing, and there's not the cash to pay for the imports.
Maybe we could talk here. I wanted to get on to Chechnya, but maybe we could talk here a little bit about economic issues. I know that the United States is concerned about the possibility of promoting greater investment in Russia. The Bush administration wants to try to help Russia become a member of the World Trade Organization. I think both recently I've read comments by both the Commerce Secretary, the Treasury Secretary, talking about what the United States can do to help the Russian economy. What can the United States do? And in particular, I think we know that joining the WTO would be a long process. It's not something that's going to happen quickly or easily. But whether that, in fact, would be something that would be a benefit to Russia.
Well, I think it would be, to the extent that they follow the rules and don't try to cheat on them. To get it to observe accounting, transparency, things of this sort. And to the more of that that goes on, then the more likely it is that Russia is going to have to follow the certain rules, although, again, they do it with adopted to local customs. They still tend to settle some of these battles violently. There is a lawsuit that was just instituted in New York against a man by the name of Deripaska, who's just created a new aluminum monopoly second only to Alcoa in the world, charging that this guy has brought together this monopoly not just by buying people out, but by shooting people out. I mean, that's a good way to do it. So there are still these problems, and that's why it represents a change for both Secretary of the Treasury O'Neill and Secretary of Commerce Evans to say suddenly now we want to lead over a group of American businesses to consider investment this fall. There are American companies that are still hurting, and it seems to me before any such movement taking businesses over there is encouraged, they should try to get a settlement on some of the others. Let me give you an example. This is from previous investors who thought that they would come and help themselves and also help the Russians. I mean, it's not a zero-sum game. Everybody was going to benefit. So a group decided they would open up a franchise of Subway sandwich. You got them there, we have them here, and they were going to have them in St. Petersburg. So they opened it up. This goes back to 1994, 95, thereabouts. They open it up, they get it operating with a Russian partner, and it's up. And a few months after it's operating to see that it can be done, the Russian partner comes in and says to the Americans, you're out of here. Just go away, and if you don't, you'll go out in a casket. The Americans decided they would appeal it. They go to Stockholm, where there was an international arbitration. They get a judgment against this bandit. He refuses to pay. They get a judgment in St. Petersburg. He refuses to pay. He get a judgment in the Russian Supreme Court. He refuses to pay. And so they have this judgment of $1.2 million. In the meantime, this operation is on the main street in St. Petersburg. It's, instead of being sandwich shop, it's called Minutka. You get it in a minute, and I was just there about 3 weeks ago, and he's operating normally without a care in the world. Hmm. Well, you can't invite investors to come over there and get taken like that. The same thing has happened to a Canadian joint venture looking for oil, and more recently there was a firm in Ohio that opened up a quartz factory for watches, that kind of quartz. And they were pushed out. So you just can't, you want them to develop, but only on the assumption that they're going to follow certain codes of behavior and observe the niceties without threatening people violently.
Yeah, it's certainly been a lot written about just how wild this effort to move toward the market economy has been. Just recently, just to name one book, I had a chance to talk with Matthew Brzezinski, who is Zbigniew Brzezinski's nephew, and spent some time in Russia writing about the changes in the economy for the Wall Street Journal. And he's got a book out now that certainly makes it sound as if Russia at that time, this was being the early 90s, was sounded like something of a combination of Wall Street in the boom time of the 80s, an odd combination of that and Chicago in the 1920s. Is it still like that?
Well,
assuming that that actually was like that.
Yeah, it was like that, and in many ways it still is like that. I mean, this example of Deripaska that I just mentioned, this Russian aluminum company, as it's called now. Now, it may not be as all over the place, as common as it was before, because many of these things are settled down now, and the monopolists have taken over. Putin has thrown some out, but he's brought in a new batch of people who are basically his favorites. So it's not that when you walk down the street you're going to be shot. I don't want to give that impression. It's not like that at all. But it still exists. If you are a Russian in business, you have to worry. You might conduct an experiment, which is what I do every time I go there. if you go as a tourist, or even if you don't go as a tourist, if you go by any building or palace or cathedral or whatever it is where tourists are likely to be taken, you'll find all kinds of vendors out there selling nesting dolls and books and pins and uniforms and things of that sort. Just ask them, how much do they have to pay the mafia to stand on that street corner? And then now you have to also ask them the second question, how much do you have to pay the police? Because the police come by, and sometimes it's hard to tell who's charging more, but they will tell you, particularly if you buy something from them, they'll tell you. They want to make sure you're not a provocateur. But and they come by every day just to take a census of who's who's there. And if you don't pay up, you're physically threatened. And if you're the police, of course, they will just harass you and without much concern for the, you know, kind of hide it. They just very blatant about the way it's done.
Hmm. In my conversation with Matthew Brzezinski, I guess I found myself thinking about some of the same things that probably I've talked about with you, because we've had some conversations about the efforts to change the economy. And I suppose it's sort of a simple-minded question, but I guess I find myself coming back to this question, why is it that in Russia this move to such a big economic change was so precipitous, that they approached it as if they could do it overnight? And it seems to be the source of a lot of their problems, the fact that there was a headlong rush into a market economy. And why was it that was the approach that was taken, almost this leap over the edge of the precipice, rather than something that would have been a little bit more measured?
Well, that's a good question, and it's actually something I'm writing about now, too. I mean, I've just finished the first draft of a book, which I'm going to call The Piratization of Russia, which is probably not too different from what Mr. Brzezinski has written, and also Krista Freeland, who's written a book called The Sale of the Century. She was a former bureau chief for the Financial Times and now is a managing editor of the Toronto Globe and Mail. I've had long conversations with Anatoly Chubayev, who was in charge of privatization at the time, and the way he saw it, and the way Yegor Gaidar saw it, who was the acting prime minister, they felt they had a very short period of time in which to do all these things, because they realized that there would be problems. They realized that the thing would explode very shortly, so they weren't sure. They lived from day to day. They weren't sure how long they were going to last. And in the case of Chubayev, he said what we were worried about was that if we didn't move quickly as we could, accomplish facts, as it were, there might be a return to the communism. The communists, you know, were really never far outside the government. They were really the dominant party until at least 1990, well, until 1999. And they could, you know, kind of hamstring the Supreme Soviet and then the Duma. And they were worried. Chubayev was very worried that this whole thing would be undone. So he wanted to create facts, as it were. He wanted to have people's capitalism and give everybody a voucher, which would give them a share of a company. The trouble is that what they didn't appreciate, and what American advisors who were urging them on this thing, and also British advisors, was that the Russians for 72 years had been told that communism was a dirty thing. I mean, capitalism was a dirty thing. That shares of stock were just pernicious and a delusion that didn't mean anything. And so when they got these shares of stock, most people didn't know what was going on, what it was for, and they were happy to get rid of it for a bottle of vodka. And this allowed them to open up the field to any bandit that wanted to come along or somebody who was very aggressive. And in the meantime, what they didn't understand is that when they destroyed central planning and state ownership, which indeed were not productive, but that was the only thing they had. They did not have a market there ready to spring up and take shape. The Western advisors, who should have known better, had never experienced a situation where there wasn't a market in existence. They'd worked in Latin America, they'd worked a little bit in Central Europe, and the market structure was there. The skeleton was there. All it had to do was let it put some fat on its bones, and it would operate. In Russia, there were no institutions. There was a void. There was a vacuum. And so if you wanted to buy a truck, you know, you didn't go down to a truck dealer. And you couldn't go back to the Soviet truck factory. So you just didn't know where to operate. And in that kind of environment, everything went crazy. There were no institutions to control things, no checks and balances.
I want to return to or go on to talk a little bit about Chechnya. When I think one of the big reasons for Mr. Putin's popularity early, you know, when he was running for president, and perhaps for his being elected president, yeah, was his tough talk about Chechnya. And in fact, on his apparently on his first day as the prime minister of Russia, and this was about 2 years ago, he said that he'd take care of this problem within 2 weeks. He'd finish this. And now it's almost 2 years later. It's still going on. It's still a bad situation. It seems to be stalemated so that it could go on. And I think perhaps some people in Russia expect that it could indeed drag on for years. People in Russia are very tired about it. They're not real happy with Mr. Putin in this regard. And recently, the Russians and what they've been doing in Chechnya has gotten bad press, even in Russia.
Well, it's an unwinnable war, you know, a little bit like Vietnam, except it's on their border. A little bit like Algeria, except that, of course, there was a Mediterranean Sea between France and Algeria. And, the Chechens are a fierce people, but they're also kind of ruthless. And this is the problem was that the earlier 94-96 war was more or less settled by default. The Russians just simply said, "Okay, we won't let you do your thing." But in the interim, then the Chechens did begin to harass the Russians and carried on some very unfortunate activities, kidnapping, beheadings, I mean, really gruesome affairs, and this was bothering the Russians. Ultimately, a rogue group invaded another part of Russia that had not been involved in this, where the Chechens really weren't welcome, and this is what triggered Putin to say, we've got to push these people out, and also, of course, and there was this bombing, several bombings in apartment houses in Moscow, among other places, which were attributed to the Chechens. It's never been proved that they did it, but it was attributed to that. And that's what really kind of broke the back of the whole thing. Putin comes as Yeltsin appoints Putin. Putin says, I'm going to take care of it. The Russians wanted somebody with going to bring order to the whole operation, not just in Chechnya, but everywhere. And Yeltsin hadn't done it. And so Putin comes in as prime minister, begins to show tough action, a man who can do these things, or at least promises to do these things, and that's what gave him his popularity. But now, as you're right, it's beginning to wear, and it's going to require that he back down if there's going to be an agreement. And so far, he's not been willing to do it. And I don't really see where it's going to go. Public concern is mounting, but so far hasn't been enough to stop it.
Yeah, I was interested in one of the stories I read about this recently. This was a story in the Post, Washington Post. It quoted an anti-Chechen war activist, a man named Lev Ponomaryov, someone who apparently had been a dissident in the Soviet times and now is important in the anti-war movement there, who says, quoted in this article, he says that citizens are passionately against the war, but they haven't yet arrived at active action against it. He says when they do, their activism will be aimed directly at Putin, because Putin became president because of the war. In the mentality of the people, Putin and the war are inseparable. And I wonder what you think about that sort of idea, and whether, in fact, that there could be a more active anti-war movement in Russia, and whether that could become a problem for Mr. Putin.
Well, it certainly could be. What Putin understands this, and that's one of the reasons why he's cracked down on the press, because he doesn't want criticism. He doesn't want to have the television cameras there, showing the bodies, showing the fighting that's going on, showing that it's not going anywhere, and the destruction that's gone on in Grozny and other parts of Chechnya. Grozny is the capital. It really can't be much worse than World War II. So this is a real problem. Putin's popularity in the meantime is about 75%. When I was just there, I met with one of the members of the Duma, the legislature, and I said, how do you explain Putin's popularity? He says, well, be careful. He said, Putin is less popular now than than Yeltsin was at this time in his term, and yet less popular than Gorbachev was in his term. And he says the hardest part lies ahead. And at that point, he thought, this was a member of the opposition party, obviously, he thought that Putin's popularity would begin to drop. Well, so far it hasn't, but partly because of Chechnya, partly because there may be some other problems with the economy, and also partly because Putin has called for more rationalization of the economy, which means that they're going to start raising prices on rents and on utilities. And also, even now, there's this kind of interesting thing, this visit of Kim Jong-il, the beloved leader of North Korea. It has caused a real fuss in Russia, particularly in Moscow. I've been watching it on Russian television. And, they just closed down everything for 2 or 3 hours because the North Korean leader has this paranoia. He can't have anybody nearby. And so the Russians are going bananas because it disrupts their travel, it disrupts their vacation. The railroads are closed down, the subways are closed down, the streets are closed down. And more than that, it reminds them of what life used to be like in the Stalinist period when some of the same practices were observed. And what is particularly disturbing is that the Russians seem to have adopted to this so quickly. We can go right back to that old mode. They had to reconstruct the guard guarding the honor guard around Lenin's tomb. It hadn't been used for many months, for a year or two or longer. They dragged them out. They had the march, and Kim Jong-il put flowers on Lenin. And it's just like, my goodness, this is the way it used to be, and that's not good for Putin either. I don't think in the long run, because it does remind people that this is a guy who came from the KGB. This is a guy, despite President Bush, who cannot trust, and somebody who is really, I don't think, all that good for his people either.
There are a couple minutes left here. We have Qualler and Champagne. We'll talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I'd like to ask. What has happened to General Lebed, and is he still a contender for the presidency of Russia? I'm going to hang up and listen. Thank
okay.
you.
Sure. General Lebed agreed or decided to run for governor in one of the remote provinces of Siberia, actually, where one of the major aluminum smelters is. And so he had to deal immediately with some of the corruption and some of the oligarchs there, and that kind of wasted his energy. And so he's just been kind of disappeared from view. He comes to Moscow periodically, but it looks like he's busy minding the house and not the country, so that he really doesn't play much of a role. It's not to say he couldn't come back someday, but his launching pad now is a much smaller one than it was before.
Just a quick thing I wanted to ask you about. Back in June, the lower house of the Russian parliament approved a bill that seemed to me to be a spectacularly bad idea that would allow for the importation and storage and reprocessing of other countries' nuclear waste into Russia. And it would require the being passed also through the upper house, and then the president would have to sign it. And I guess I haven't heard anything more about this, and I wonder where that stands.
I think that the upper house has not acted fully yet. It's in recess for vacation, and we'll probably have to wait till the fall. I follow the lower thing, and I'm not absolutely certain that it has not been passed on. But Putin approved it, and I say the lower, the Duma approved it. that also is stirring concern. But some of the remote areas that had agreed to take this nuclear waste, said, this is a way for us to earn income, which is really, I think, in many ways, pretty short-sighted. But that's where it stands, as far as I know.
Hmm. And it seems it's something that public opinion polls say most Russians would say, this is not a good. This is not a good thing. We should do this.
They're very much against it because even though it may be in somebody else's province, oblast, it's still. Never know where these things go, if they're underground streams or whatever it might be.
Hmm. Well, at that, I guess we'll close out. I want to say to you, Professor Goldman, thanks very much once again for talking with us.
Well, it's always fun. I grew up in Illinois, and I was happy to Go back.
We appreciate the time. Our guest this morning, Marshall Goldman. He is Associate Director of the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard University.